We are so honored to have in studio with us Republican nominee for Lieutenant Governor Hal Weatherman. You can follow him on Twitter at HalWeathermanNC. Also go to his website, HalWeatherman4NC.com. You can link to all of his social media there. Follow him on Facebook. I have given him a new hashtag. Hashtag Handshake Hal. We talked about this last time that you were in. At that point, it had been and welcome to the show. We're so glad you're here.
I'm glad to be here.
I know. Dear friend, I just jump right into our conversation. You did something that no other Council of State candidate was doing, no other statewide candidate was out doing it. At the Trump Charlotte rally, you started at the front of the line and shook about 10,000 plus hands until your back went out.
Yeah.
I watched you do it in Asheville. We had about 15,000 lining the streets in the San Francisco of the South for what I would say was probably one of the best rallies I've ever been to for President Trump. I've watched you do it because I follow all of what you do on social media because I love this campaign, and we're going to talk about really what makes your campaign so unique. You were doing this in Labor Day parades that felt like they were going Murphy to Manio. I mean, the Weatherman bus was traveling this state like crazy. You have taken on, and I think it's just really at the core of what you've done, you have a long career. You're a North Carolina native, grew up in Charlotte, Wake Forest undergrad, long career working with other elected officials, chief of staff for former Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, Congresswoman Sue Myrick, mayor. She was also the mayor of Charlotte, obviously. You've spent a lot of time over the course of the last couple of years on your nonprofit, which is focused on election integrity, a really critical issue, a bipartisan issue, although they want to paint it very much Republican. But you've always had kind of this old school retail politics approach to everything. Anyone who's ever seen any office that you've ever had, it is nostalgia of old school politics. It's kind of at the heart of who you are as a person. Yeah. The signs you have, the stickers you have, kind of the decor there. Your campaign has taken that on really from day one. You had a very crowded primary. You had a runoff. In the runoff, you won 99 of 100 counties. But your approach has been very clean and clear. No radio ads, no TV ads during the primary. It was literally shaking hands, but it was old school retail politics, which I think spoke to voters in a way that no one else was doing. Did you feel that out on the campaign trail?
Oh yeah, I mean I love old school politics. You know, it's not so much the politics; it's just, you know, going out and meeting with people and talking with them, and I enjoy doing that. And I don't know, there's just something that we have somehow lost in society. I really do believe that. You know, as technology has come into the fold. 30-second sound bites, you know. That's how we run campaigns now, 30-second sound bites. 90% of it's negative, ripping to shreds the other guy or the other woman. And I just disagree with that. I just think it's wrong. And so I'm not against advertising at all. I'm not saying we won't do advertising in this campaign here in the general because the numbers get too big. I can't meet with everybody. But the first fruits of our time and money and labor and passion and all that will continue to go into traveling the state and trying to meet with as many people as we can. The Trump rallies are great. You know, you're right. We in Charlotte, we did shake over 10,000 people's hands. It was 104 degrees on the tarmac on the pavement. People were dropping like flies. I checked the paper the next day. 44 people got taken to the hospital for heat. And I love that style of campaign. I love going out there and just shaking hands one after the other. And the thing is, it's good and it's bad. I mean, you have to have thick skin. People tell you to your face what's good, what's bad, what they disagree with, what you're not doing right. If you fail to get back to them, I mean, we get that. You know, you'll walk through. Hey, I called you, and you know, you'll get it all. And so, but I, you know, that's what your elected officials, and I'm not elected yet, but that's. Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? Aren't we supposed to be there, accessible? I mean, you don't have to worry about how am I going to contact you, and you know, you're talking to me face to face, you know, and I hand out my cards. You know, I've got my personal cell on it. When there's a problem or something, you know, I'll give them their card and my card and say call me, and I'll return the call and happy to do it. But yeah, I think people do. I think they do enjoy that style of campaigning. I think they miss it. I think that's the way it used to be. And what we do, you know, our upgrade is we old school it, but then we digital it and we put it out there. And so that's kind of the old meets the new, and it brings people into the fold. And then they, you know, the goal is to build a movement and to give people ownership of the campaign and let them feel a part of the campaign. And I can tell by the comments, because, you know, I read the comments. I mean, if people want to get, you know, you can always contact me directly. But don't underestimate that I don't go through and read my comments on a regular basis. I don't do it every day. I can't. But, you know, we travel a lot. Mm-hmm. And while we're traveling, I'll sit there and scroll through the comments and comment back, you know. And so I just love it. I love that style of campaigning because it really is communicating with people to their face. And what's wrong with that?
Right. You know? And I think people are hungry for it. And again, we're talking with Hal Weatherman, Republican nominee for lieutenant governor. You can follow him on Twitter at Hal Weatherman NC. Go to his website, HalWeatherman4NC.com. Follow his Facebook. You can link right to it from his website. And it is interesting because you put up today, and this is just such a prime example, you put up today a tweet that you were going to be here on the show. And then I got a Facebook message from someone who we both know who lives outside of Wilmington, so excited. And you know, they have to listen to us online, but it is that kind of touch, right? And we realize the organic reach of social. Mm-hmm. And you've used your Facebook page almost like this digital newsletter, right? Here's and calendar almost simultaneously. Here's where we are. Here's what we're doing. Yeah. And people feel very plugged in to the campaign.
And then they feed it too. Like people, you know, I can't remember where I put it. And 99% of the stuff we post is me. I'm posting it in the car. I'm literally posting it. You know,
from the passenger seat.
From the passenger seat. Yeah. No, I do, because I want to actually, to me, that is the campaign.
Yes.
It's chronicling what we're doing. And so I don't want an intermediary there. I want to know when we're putting stuff out, it's because I want it out or if I want to respond to something or whatever. But it, you know, what I love about it is, you know, like we do spotted. If we see a bumper sticker or something, we, you know, we're like spotted in. And I can't tell you how many people will send stuff to me saying spotted in, and it's like I had a good friend, I won't name because some of the people might know that, but I have a good friend who sent me today, and I just put it up before I got here, and I can't remember if I put it on Instagram, if we put it on Twitter yet, but, I know I put it like Facebook stories, but it's a good friend of mine whose grandpa has dementia. And I was very close to this. He's in his 90s. I was very close to him for a long time. And still close, but he has dementia now. And on his own, he put up my sign in his yard. And his daughter sent that to me and said, my dad put this up himself. He said he's very much, you know, in the throes of dementia, but he will tell everybody who comes in, Hal Weatherman, vote for Hal Weatherman. And that just made me cry. You know what he told me? And I'm like, oh, my God, that's awesome. And so she said spotted in, you know, and I won't name the town, but did the town, and I didn't disclose the town, but it's a beautiful picture. It's a beautiful home, and it's just an old sign that he still had laying around from the primary, and he put it up on his own. You can tell he put it up himself, mm-hmm. and I love that. Like, that's probably one of my favorite pictures of the whole campaign.
Isn't that great?
And I love when people do that, you know, when you're campaigning, because they feel vested in it, and I feel connected to them.
Right, right. And, you know, it's interesting. And we're talking with Republican nominee for Lieutenant Governor Hal Weatherman. Follow him on Twitter at Hal Weatherman NC. Visit his website, HalWeatherman4NC.com. You know, you've been on the other side, right? You've helped candidates get elected. This is your first time running for elected office. You know, there's no greater gift. And I think, you know, I hope every candidate really feels this way, because I know you do. You and I have discussed it before. There's really no greater gift than someone can give you than their vote, right? And you have to earn it. You hope, right, that you're earning it. And when you're out there shaking hands with 10,000 people in 104-degree heat in Charlotte, you're making the trip over to Asheville, shaking hands with 15,000 people who are lined up down the streets in Asheville to see President Trump. You're working parades, you know, and I watch you do it in those big crowds. I watch you do it in small crowds, 25 people that show up at a GOP meeting or wherever the case may be. That's about earning the votes and connecting with the voters.
It is, and honestly, I mean, I don't understand why more politicians don't do it. I really don't, because, you know, the feedback you get back from people is, and I get this daily now, because, you know, yes, we did Trump at Charlotte, we did Greensboro, we did Asheville, we did Asheboro. if you were to add up collectively the hands we just shook on those 4 dates, just 4 dates out of 20 months worth of campaigning, we're on the road every day, you're probably looking at close to 50,000 people mm-hmm. that we actually shook hands with. And so there's not a day that goes by that we don't go somewhere and, you know, I'll meet somebody and I'm like, hey, I'm having, well, we actually met before in Asheboro. You shook my hand or, and I love that because they remembered it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, you know, oh, I saw you on TV or whatever, and they may or may not, but they feel a connection, and I hope they feel a connection. But again, it goes both ways. It's not a, you know, it's instant gratification in the sense that it's instant feedback from the people. But what's healthy about it for me is not just that it feels good. It's that that is how – I don't need a poll. I mean, I'll look at polls if somebody commissions one. I'll look at it and try to glean some insight from it. But when you're on the road every day and you're shaking hands with people, you don't need to look at polls. That is the poll.
Right.
That's the people telling you what they want, and they will tell you. I mean, Sue Myrick told me that years ago. She was one of the few politicians – that would go to Washington, and she would come home every Thursday night, go back to D.C. every Monday morning. That's a big commitment. You have to fly back and forth. A lot of politicians go up to D.C. and stay in D.C. They'll stay through the weekend, and they get in that little bubble, and they never come home. And Sue said, no, I will always go to the grocery store every week in Charlotte because they all know who she is. And they will walk up, and they will tell her to her face what's good and what's bad. And she said, well, the second I stop doing that, I need to retire. Because that's where I get my best information from. And I feel the same way, you know. And I feel like Sue trained me. And so, that you know, I'm always going
to
do that.
Yeah, and they're going to tell you in the grocery store today, look at how much this costs compared to what it cost 3 years ago. And you're going to get that feedback and that insight. You know, let's talk a little bit about what the role of lieutenant governor is. I mean, I always think it's so important for our listeners. I know you put a big effort behind this as you're talking to folks. You know, there are certain roles that people understand. The lieutenant governor is an interesting role in the state of North Carolina because we don't vote for our governor and lieutenant governor with one ballot. You're separated. The lieutenant governor has some very specific roles. Just do a recap for our listeners, if you could, about what the lieutenant governor in the state of North Carolina does, the key responsibilities for the LG.
I mean, you're the president of the Senate, of the state Senate, so you're the presiding officer. You don't set the agenda necessarily, and you don't give the committee assignments. A lot of that responsibility was stripped from the office of lieutenant governor back in the 80s by the Democrat Party when they were in charge of the General Assembly. But you are the president of the Senate. You serve on the State Board of Education as a voting member. You serve on the State Board of Community Colleges as a voting member. You serve as chairman of what's called the Energy Policy Council, which is a fairly obscure entity, but it's very, you know, it gives you the ability to vet all energy policy getting ready to come before the General Assembly and make recommendations. And, you know, show me a state without good, reliable, affordable baseline, baseload energy, and I'll show you a state that doesn't exist, right? I mean, you're not going to prosper as a state. And so it's very important from an economic development standpoint. And then other than that, you know, there's some other limited board appointments that you have. But really, you become a force multiplier for the governor and or the General Assembly. The state constitution is clear. The governor can assign duties to a lieutenant governor, and the General Assembly can assign duties to the General Assembly or to the lieutenant governor. And so, you know, it's all of the above. I would like to play a role in economic development over and above the core duties of the job. I'd like to play a role in economic development. I have a passion for rural North Carolina. 85 of our 100 counties are rural. I grew up in a rural county. They have challenges that are unique. We have a great economic prosperity in North Carolina, but so much of that prosperity is rooted in Raleigh and Charlotte. And I hate to say I want to spread it out, but I want to spread that out. I want to make sure that everybody's getting their a level playing field so that they can compete and prosper. And a lot of those rural counties need some help. And so, you know, it's all of that. The other thing is the obvious is you're a governor in waiting. I mean, 5 times in our state history, the governor's either died in office, been incapacitated in some way, removed for office. And so we have an automatic succession plan. So the lieutenant governor of North Carolina automatically ascends to the governorship. And so you have to think about that when you elect a lieutenant governor. Does the person have the wisdom, the experience to preside over 98,000 state employees, to be the commander-in-chief of the Guard, Air National Guard and the Ground Guard, here in North Carolina? Can they have virtual unilateral control of the real estate holdings of the great state of North Carolina, which are voluminous? And there's very little check or balance there. The Council of State provides some check on that, but the governor has almost unilateral control of all real estate holdings of the state. And so, you know, you have to think about these things. When you elect a lieutenant governor, you are electing a, you know, God forbid something happens to the governor, whoever that governor is, it's an automatic succession. It's immediate. And so it's just like a vice president is. And so you have to think about those things. But, you know, I think I have a very unique background, basically 30 years of experience, state and federal, as a chief of staff. I never put myself out front. I was always behind the scenes. But I also worked with one family, really, Sue Myrick and Dan Forrest. Dan Forrest is Sue's son. And so I worked, you know, 27, 28 years for one family as their in-house consultant, chief of staff, handling all their political affairs, either government and or campaign. And, you know, I learned so much from them. And I just think it's a good training for the office of lieutenant governor. I tell people there'll be no on the job training for me. I'll hit the ground running, you know, day one. I'm ready. I've already served in the office of lieutenant governor. A lot of people don't realize the chief of staff is actually the head of the agency. The office of lieutenant governor is a state agency, and a lot of people don't realize that. And the presiding officer of the agency is not the lieutenant governor; it's the chief of staff. So I've already run that agency. It's a small agency, but we've run it. And I've served under a Republican governor, and I've served under a Democrat governor. I prefer to serve under a Republican. But I know what all that's like. I've worked with the General Assembly, and I've traveled the state. More importantly than anything is the travel of the state. And I've said this repeatedly on your show and around the state. I just think if you're going to run the state as a governor, lieutenant governor, if you're going to run the state, if you're going to preside over the state, if you're going to lead a state, you need to know the state. And you need to know it intimately. And, you know, you look back on your career and you're in a support role and for all those years. And then you look back on it and you're like, wow, what great training. This afforded me the ability to travel hundreds of thousands of miles all in state, gone to all 100 counties multiple times. You get to see the good of your state, get to see the bad of your state, the strengths of your state, the weaknesses of your state. And you start to think about who else would have that experience. There's very few people who do. There are plenty of General Assembly people or other elected officials, but they're limited in scope to their small district or their county or their maybe two or three counties. There's only a handful of people, just a handful of people that have spent the last 10 years traveling the state and learning the entire state in its entirety. And then you look back. This is why my wife and I think feel called to do this is, you know, she was the first one to broach the conversation with me. Why aren't you running for lieutenant governor? Like, who knows the state? Who knows the job as well as you do? Like, why would you not? Why would you do that? Because I had people calling, you know, asking, will you run my campaign or do you want to help me run for lieutenant governor? And I'm like, why would I not do that? And I'd never thought that before. I'm like, because I was, you know. And but this time it took, and we were like, yeah, and I have no regrets. It's been an awesome experience. Listen, it's hard to travel the state. It's hard. It's a big state. It is such a big state. And we have literally been on the road 5 and 6 days a week continuously for 20 straight months, and I consider it all joy, even the bad days. It, you know, the days that your head hurts or, you know, or you broke your pinky because you shook too many hands, which has happened twice, consider it all joy. Like, this is what it's about. It's what you signed up for, and I love it, you know, and I hope I win. I do, not being selfish at all, but it would be my honor. Like, truly, I would wake up every day thinking, what an honor, what a privilege I have that God has given me, that the people of this state have given me to represent them. And, you know, I look for every opportunity during the campaign, and I'll do the same thing if I'm elected, to bring hope to people. I mean, you know, some people argue the office of lieutenant governor has no power or, you know, has limited power or it's all about ambition, all that. You know what it gives, what I'm excited about? That when I walk in, for most people, when you meet them and they're like, are you really the lieutenant governor? Are you really the number two person in the state? And you're like, I am. Whatever it is that you're bringing to them that day, an award, commending them for something. Maybe you're visiting the sick or the shut-in or a wounded warrior or, you know, a parent of a slain child or, you know, whatever. When you're doing that on behalf of the state, it means something to the person on the other end. And I'm going to devote, outside of my duties, outside of my appointments, outside of, you know, work, I'm going to work as hard if I'm elected as I am on the campaign trail. I'm going to find daily opportunities to go in and say, you know what, I have another duty that's not clearly defined. And it is to, on behalf of a grateful state, lift other people up from our state. I don't think we've done a good job of that. You know, one of the things and I don't know what our time commitment is here, but one of the things that I don't really campaign on, it is in my platform. If you go on my website, halweatherman.com, you'll see it's one of the last things I list. Not because it's not important, but, you know, it's not the sexiest of all things. But it's something that on the day that I decided to run that I wanted to do. I want North Carolina to have a North Carolina Hall of Fame. And I would like to initiate that as lieutenant governor, because I don't think we do a good job, not an excellent job, I should say, of lifting up our own and commemorating the achievements and the contributions of people in this state that have made a difference. I literally, when I was coming in here, like literally 7-8 minutes ago, right before I walked in the door, was on the phone, I don't think you'd mind me saying, with Dr. Tony Atala from Winston-Salem. And, you know, how many people would know Dr. Tony Atala in this state? Very few. This man has changed more lives than probably most people. I mean, he's going to go down in history. I think he'll win the Nobel Prize. I really do. Because he invented regenerative medicine, where you're not treating injuries. You are wholesale healing them. Like, he's the first person in the world to completely replace a bladder for someone, not treat it. He takes and he developed all this. He'll take a 3D image of your double-celled organ. You can only do double cells, single cell and double cell, which a bladder is a double-cell organ. So he'll take a 3D image of that. And then he'll build a construct using a 3D printer that he invented. He literally got the original one off the floor of Staples, took it in, developed it, retooled it. Now they make them very high grade. And he will make a 3D image out of composite material of your bladder. So it's an exact duplicate of your bladder, exact, right? And then he'll scrape the inside of your organ and the outside of your organ. He'll put both of those cells into Petri dishes, and he'll incubate them for 3 weeks. He'll then take the incubated Petri dishes, and he'll transplant your cells that have now replicated in that Petri dish to the inside and outside of that bladder. He'll schedule surgery. He'll take your bladder out that's injured or whatever it is, disease-ridden. He'll take it out. He'll put a new bladder in that looks like your bladder and is your bladder. Does that make sense?
It does.
That's regenerative medicine in a nutshell. You don't treat that bladder the rest of your life. The bladder is cured. It has a 100% acceptance rate. There is no rejection. It's your cells. It's your bladder. Same image, same everything. The composite material that he built it out of is flushed out of your body naturally, and all that's left behind is a new bladder. And he can do that. He's in different stages of FDA approval for all double cell organs in the human body. And most people don't even know that that's here. They don't even know that's here. We are the leaders in the world of regenerative medicine because of Dr. Tony Atala. See, I want to lift him up. I want to make him one of the first inductees into the North Carolina Hall of Fame. Why? Because, one, he's going to wind up saving millions of lives. And most people in our state don't even know him. See, I want our state to commemorate our people. I want to lift them up every day. Does that make sense?
It does. And creating an environment where the ingenuity of that, you know, can thrive and grow. Because where it is today, you know, we could be having this conversation in 5 years, and it's at a whole different level. But it had to start somewhere with someone like that it's amazing.
The ripple effect is amazing. And,
right.
And the impact to your state, I mean, again, I was just talking to him. He spearheads an economic development effort that's going on there that basically stems from his work. And they just got a $163 million grant to do an economic development part that's healthcare related for that. Do you understand how many jobs he's going to create over the life? I mean, it's going to extend way past his life.
Right.
But it's all from his vision. And he invented all of this in an emergency room. He was an ER doctor 50 years ago, 40 years ago, and a young 12-year-old girl came in with a punctured bladder. And he patched it the only way he could with a piece of her intestines, knowing that it had about a 5 to 8 year shelf life, which means she was going to die. She wasn't going to live to be 18 years old, 19 years old. as the best option out there. And he said, there's got to be a better way. And so he invented this. That's how he did it. I'm sorry, we should commemorate that. We should lift that up. And then he's dedicated his life to it. Mm-hmm. You know, and he works for Bowman Gray, Wake Forest University or whatnot. And, you know, he could have easily gone out and commercialized all this on his own. Instead, he works through government grants and things like that. He's giving back to the community. He just wants to solve the problem, not necessarily get, you know, rich off of it.
Right.
I think we should commemorate that.
Yeah, and you have people like that, and because you have traveled this state, you've been so engaged. There are North Carolinians doing varying levels of greatness like that across the state.
Oh yeah,
and you know, there's
Bojangles was founded here. That's pretty great. I mean, it's a total different avenue, right?
Right.
But I mean, you invent something that goes national or international, and you know, I'm thinking, why don't we commemorate? One time when I worked for Danforest, we used to always put up, when things like this would pop up, like the day that that commemorates when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up, mm-hmm. which I remember well. I was in grade school.
And
I remember it. And but, you know, Captain Mike Smith was the captain of that, and he's from New Bern. And we posted something on our Facebook page that day. We did it every year that commemorated that day. We'd put his picture up there and said, North Carolina remembers its own. Captain Mike Smith. Challenger space shuttle and put the date. And it's a simple thing to do. But I wish I could remember which member of their family, but a member of his family contacted our office, and I took the call because they didn't know who to give it to. And I took the call, and they're just like, I just want to thank you for that. Nobody ever remembers that was my dad or my uncle or whoever it was. I want to thank you for that. And that's one of the, you know, I even thought about that. I talked to Dan about it. You know, at some point we should start a Hall of Fame. I mean, we have the Beach Music Hall of Fame. We have the North Carolina Sports Hall of Fame. You know, we have different halls
NASCAR.
Of fame. NASCAR Hall of Fame. But we should do something that's unique to North Carolina that commemorates achievements, accolades, yes, but, you know, good for humanity, good for jobs, good for people, all of it, and put it all under one roof. I actually think it'd be a huge economic generator as well.
Absolutely.
People would love to visit it.
They would. Yeah. We're talking with Hal Weatherman, Republican nominee for lieutenant governor. You can follow him on Twitter at Hal Weatherman NC. Visit his website, Hal Weatherman 4NC. Follow him on all of his social media, especially if you're a Facebook user. Hal's Facebook is spectacular. Just gives you I know exactly where you are, kind of all the time, and all the things that you're doing. It's fantastic. I've given Hal, jokingly, a hashtag of Handshake Hal, because you truly have. And we talked about this in the first segment, shaking, you know, just at four Trump rallies, I think you're north of 50,000 hands, broken your pinky twice. Those are some hard shaken hands.
Right there.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good story. You can't see it on the radio, but his pinky has a little giddy up in it. That's a real medical term. A little giddy up. You know, we've talked a lot about kind of the role of lieutenant governor, not only in this segment, but the many, many times that we've had you on the show, the role that they play in the Board of Education, the Community College Board, energy policy. You have a long history in constituent services. You really understand the importance of serving North Carolinians. One of the things that you've really hit on, I've heard you do it not only on the stump, we've talked about it on the show, it's on your website, you talk about it in your posts as well, the importance of protecting North Carolina's farmland and the electrical grid, and really looking at foreign infiltration into these places. You know, it's hard sometimes for people who live right here in Wake County to, you know, reminding people that ag is our number one industry. Agriculture is our number one industry. And every time that Commissioner of Agriculture Steve Troxler is on the ballot, which is every 4 years, he gets more votes than anyone. Farming knows no partisan lines at all. But, you know, you've been really strong in your conviction and commitment to this. Tell our listeners about why it's so important, especially in a state like North Carolina, to protect our farmland from foreign ownership, to protect the electrical grid, kind of that strong infrastructure and economy impact for us.
Well, I mean, agriculture is our largest industry. It's up to 112 now, billion a year annual business. And there's no reason we can't grow it to a $200 billion plus annual industry. There's really nothing stopping us from doing this. Steve Troxler, the Commissioner of Agriculture, has done an amazing job. And really, if you sit down and talk with him, he'll share a vision with you of how we do that. And, you know, one of the things that I want to do, and I mean, I'll answer your question about the security side of it, but, you know, I want to do my part as lieutenant governor to help grow that industry to a $200 billion. I'm a big fan of food processing. You know, I look at the trends of the world. Our world population's exceeded 8 billion people. We can't feed the world. There's a, you know, global shortage of food, getting food to the right people around the world. So, you know, we come from an ag state. We have a God-given opportunity right now in this time in our history to help feed the world. And but to do that, to feed the world, you know, in North Carolina, our primary market's the fresh market, and there's nothing wrong with that. But when you grow for the fresh market, you know, if you want to sell to the world, you've got to process your food. You got to preserve your food. And so we need to make some critical infrastructure improvements in North Carolina. And Troxler is doing that. The General Assembly's done some of that. I think had Danforth won the governorship, we'd be neck deep in it right now in a good way. But we're not quite there as a state yet. You know, we need to, I'd like to see the rail line in Morehead City be ripped up. It runs right through the middle of the downtown area. We need to reroute it. And you do that because we need to get larger boats into the Morehead City deep water port. But to do that, you know, to unload those larger boats, you're going to have to shut down the downtown for 3 days. You're going to cripple their economy, something that the forefathers of that city never thought about. And if you reroute the rail line, then you got to reroute the connecting road system, which is expensive. And then our state needs to make, and we're doing some of it, but we need to invest in what are called inland ports. These are where the farmers ship their goods over tractor trailer there, then put it on the rail line, then ship it down to Morehead City or Wilmington. And once you get it there, you can't put it on the boat yet. You got to store it. You got to put it on cold storage. And we only have about 20%. North Carolina only has about 20% of the cold storage capacity that our neighboring ports, our competitor ports in Norfolk and Charleston have. And so you start connecting these dots, you realize we need to make investments in each one of these dots, right, and then connect the dots. And, you know, all of that to be said, which goes right into your question, I remember working for Dan, I think it was the first year of our first term, China tried to buy Radio City Island, which is the island right off the body of land, right off of Morehead City Deepwater Port. And the question is, why did China try to do that, right? Because China looked at the world population about to exceed 8 billion and realized, hey, we have a global shortage of food. We should go into food processing, and we need access to deepwater ports. And how frustrating that is that China sees the potential of North Carolina. And my question to North Carolinians is, do you? Do you see the potential you have to feed the world? How do you grow agriculture in North Carolina from a $112 billion annual industry to a $200 billion annual industry? Make the improvements I just said and then feed the world. And then you're going to reap the economic benefits of that for decades and generations. And it's not just Eastern North Carolina. People always think ag, they think Eastern North Carolina. You know, yes, I mean, we're leaders in turkeys and chickens and broilers, in Christmas trees. And basically all kinds of vegetation,
sweet
for salads,
potatoes.
Sweet potatoes. We have so much to offer. And the flip side of it is, too, and a lot of people don't make this connection, 80% of all commercial applications of drone technology comes from agriculture. Think about that. 80% of all commercial application of drone technology is being driven by the agriculture industry. And if you think about it, it makes sense. You fly up a drone over farms. It can cover wide swaths of material, of acreage. It can tell you what needs watering, where you need pesticide, this, that. What would take days of driving the farm and making snap judgments of, no, you can just identify it right then. So, you know, you're going to have better yields, better productivity. And so you want to preserve your farmland for the farms to feed, right? And I tell people all the time, if China owns our farms, China owns us. They control our food, they control us, and we don't need that. But over and above that, we have a burgeoning aerospace cluster forming in the center part of our state, in part by Honda Jet being headquartered in Greensboro. And if you actually look, there's a supply chain system birthed all around that. If you realize the connection between pilotless aircraft and agriculture, the 80% of the commercial technology comes through that, then you realize if you have protected land, you have protected airspace. And if you have protected airspace, then drone companies will want to come do their R&D in your state because they have to have protected airspace. And farmland is empty space. And so a lot of people don't make that connection. I tell you, the states that have, Alabama, Texas, they figured this out a long time ago. They figured out, hey, if you're in an ag state, you're also in the aerospace business. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy how you connect the dots? This is why I tell people you have to travel the state to learn the state. When you learn these things, you realize the opportunities. So there's more than just, but yes, you know, back to your real question about, you know, protecting the land or whatnot, you know, there is a standing committee in the U.S. Department of Treasury. It's federal, it's not state, and it's called CFIUS, C-I-F-I-U-S. I have no clue what it stands for. I used to know, but I can't, who can keep track of the acronyms? In a nutshell, they have free jurisdiction to any money that comes into, any foreign investment that comes into to the United States. They can block. They can deem it subversive and block it. And they do routinely. You see this when some of the Middle Eastern countries would try to buy our port system. And that's happened, like under George Bush, they tried to buy some of the ports. And CFIUS blocked it and said, no, we're not going to allow that. And then Congress acted accordingly. My understanding is that CFIUS doesn't have – it operates like on a seven-step system. They safeguard against foreign investment in seven different areas, but one of the areas they don't safeguard in, because that charter has never been granted to them by Congress, is food supply. And one thing I'd like to do as lieutenant governor is to lobby, hopefully, the Trump administration to get his U.S. Department of Treasury to work with Congress to alter the CFIUS guidelines to where they start to put food security – into the same potential subversive activities that they can block. Does that make sense?
It does, because when we look at North Carolina, it's so interesting because we talk about ag as such a big industry. You have to really kind of tie in as well the strong military presence in North Carolina, right? I mean, two huge national security vulnerabilities, but key national security efforts right here in North Carolina. There's a reason that you know, according to the Biden administration, the weather balloon, but let's call it what it is, the Chinese balloon was flying across and went over every single one of our military installations. And not only, I'm sure they were capturing visions of the farmland as well. There's a reason they're trying, you know, to your point, Hal, you've talked about this so many times. And again, we're talking with Hal Weatherman, Lieutenant Governor nominee from the Republican Party. Visit his website, HalWeatherman4NC.com. Follow him on Twitter at HalWeathermanNC. Follow him on Facebook as well, talking about the importance of protecting North Carolina farmland and, of course, all American farmland. But you're running for the LG here. You know, we've got to protect the farmland, protect the military installation, and look at, to your point, when you travel this state as you've done and worked in the state for so long, recognizing the growth and prosperity opportunities there and where there are gaps, where there is an industry that isn't protected that should be, and what that can do not only from a national security standpoint but a revenue standpoint for the state.
Yeah. The other thing, you know, the state could play a role in potentially blocking some of this as well. I mean, the General Assembly could definitely do that. But, you know, so much of the land, the farmland that China's buying up, they actually buy through basically shadow organizations, LLCs, at the state level. And so, you know, nonprofits or LLCs through the state level. I mean, those are both registered with the North Carolina Secretary of State's office. And so, you know, you can't get one of those designations without going through that office. And they're funded by the General Assembly. And so, you know, there is a nexus point there through the funding, the power of the purse. I'm not an attorney, but, you know, again, if I'm elected lieutenant governor, we will work very strongly to get some kind of protection put in there. Very similar to Arkansas. You know, Arkansas took a very bold move, which I thought was great. By the way, coincidentally, this is so interesting. The former lieutenant governor of Arkansas, Tim Griffin's a friend of mine. He's actually the attorney general now of Arkansas, but he's a former lieutenant governor. He's from Charlotte, North Carolina. Isn't that cool? We went to kindergarten together.
I love that.
Yeah, he called me when I announced. He shot me a text, and he said, "Hey, if you win," because we both went to a school that his dad started that does not exist anymore. It was called Carolina Christian, small school. This is 1976. He said, "Hey, if you win, do you realize that both Arkansas and North Carolina will have a lieutenant governor that came from Carolina Christian, a small school that doesn't even exist?" Isn't that weird?
So we have family from Arkansas. We'll get back to this, but I will say Arkansas to me is the Kevin Bacon of all the states.
That's true. 6 degrees of separation.
All of it goes through Arkansas. You know, we were in the Outer Banks on vacation. We have a place there, and some people came to church that had driven from Arkansas, And so we're talking to them. Do you know so-and-so? So yeah, do you know my cousin Tim Allison? Oh, he does color commentating for Arkansas State. Oh, his uncle did this family member's funeral and this one's wedding and baptized this one. And you just, Arkansas is, it's the Kevin Bacon.
Yeah. Totally.
There we go.
Yeah, there you have it.
And you know, I think we'll just speak it into reality that that little Charlotte,
Carolina Christian
school produced two lieutenant governors.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Well, that would be very cool.
Yeah.
That would be, and you know, it's interesting as, you know, and I'm always blown away every time I talk to you, Hal. I have been since, you know, we've been friends for a long time. You know, I said this early on when you first jumped into the LG race. I was asked, did an interview out in Western North Carolina, and I said, no one knows the job of lieutenant governor better than Hal Weatherman. No one knows the job better than Hal Weatherman. And each and every time I talk to you, each and every time our listeners get an opportunity to hear you, each interview that you do, I am reminded that no one knows the state of North Carolina, I think, really better than you do. And it isn't just the Murphy to Manio travel that you continue to do, and we both know the state doesn't even actually end at either of those places, but it's a good, you know, it makes for a good sign, right?
Yeah.
Murphy to Manio.
Yeah.
But it's the 50,000 handshaking, but it's understanding and looking through a keen eye at what's going on in this community. What are the challenges that this community faces? What are the opportunities within this community? And looking at each one of the 100 counties with that same level of opportunistic view, I think, has been really a valuable asset to you.
Yeah, and you know, listen, it's not rocket science. I'm not saying it's not a big job. I'm saying sometimes people overcomplicate things. Like, I go back to when Dan Forrest was elected, and I was his chief of staff. And you know, what we did at the beginning of the term, it's just common sense. But yet, it's shocking how many politicians won't do these things. I mean, the first thing that we did is we called up every member of the General Assembly at the time and said, can we come over and just meet with you? And we just started to say, what makes you tick? What's important to you? What do you stand for? You know, et cetera, et cetera. We did the same thing through the governor's office. We said we would like to start going through every agency that's under your control, not under the other council, like Department of Ag's under Troxler, but, you know, basically the cabinet position. Can we start walking through your agencies? And we would walk through the agencies. Like, literally, we would walk through the agency. Dan would go cubicle to cubicle to cubicle to cubicle to office to cubicle to office and say, I am the Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest. And we would shake hands for days. You know, we had our duties, we'd do our job and all that, but he would budget, said, all right, let's take 2 hours today and let's go shake hands over at Department of, you know, DIT, or, you know, at Department of Technology, or Department of Commerce, and we would do that. And we had more than one. There were several, but we had grown men who I'd never name cry. We had one man sat there. It was very moving, and he was in a back office and very government looking office, windowless, and. And after Dan, you know, was walking out, he cried. He you could see the tears welling up, and he said, I've been here 30 years. Nobody's ever said thank you to me. I've never met a governor or a lieutenant governor or a nobody. I'm about to retire. I'm like, does anybody care? You know, they're thinking, does this matter? And you understand all those are – that should be common sense.
Mm-hmm.
These are the things we should be doing. And what happens when you do that? Again, it's not a PR thing. They'll tell you. They'll tell you what the problem is. You know what you ought to do? That's what they'll say. You know what you ought to do? What you guys ought to do up there? And they'll tell you. And, you know, those are where your solutions come from. And so, you know, that's what I want to do. I want to lay that down over the state government. The other thing that we did, which I'm going to do as well, I take serious the fact that if I win, whoever the governor is, I hope it's Mark Robinson, but whoever the governor is, God forbid something happens to that person.
Right.
We're in a hurricane state. You know, I think there's going to be all kinds of terrorism in the United States over the next 4-8 years because of what's happened on our southern border. You know, the first thing that we did is we went over and did a hurricane simulation with Pat McCrory, where they brought in the entire command center, and we sat through a cert training, and we got certified, and we sat through all of it. So that, why? Because you have to take serious. The next thing we did is we went and met with every one of the commanding officers of all of it, Seymour Johnson, Fort Bragg. I still call it Fort Bragg. I'm always going to call it Fort Bragg. Camp Lejeune, Cherry Point, went met with all of them. Why? Because we might be their commander in chief. We're one heartbeat away from being their commander, and you don't know when that's going to happen. And so Dan was adamant about, we're going to make sure that every one of our core duties, we're going to go check off and know that we know how to do that. So that, you know, and that's just good leadership.
Yeah, and you're ready.
You're ready.
Because you don't know when the call will come.
That's exactly
right.
You've
got to be ready.
And so I'm going to do the same thing. So, yes, I do know the job, but I'm going to go through the exact same exercise. On day one of my job, I'm going to, you know, lay out our staff, do all that. But then I'm going to go right back through the same thing. Who are all our generals? Where are all our assets? Where are all our things deployed? Where is it, what is our emergency operations center? I'm going to go back through all of it, make sure I know the EMS director and all the different things. Why? Because that's what you're there to do. And I think that we live in a dangerous world, and our leaders have to be creative and think about what's the worst case scenario that could happen and prepare for it. Because I think that's the world we live in today. And so, yeah, I don't know where I was going with that. But
no,
that,
it's
I'm
great.
Excited about it. I want to get that chance.
Yes.
I really do. It was my honor to do it with Dan, but I'd like to do it as well myself. And see how that goes.
There you go. We're talking with Hal Weatherman, Republican nominee for lieutenant governor. Follow him on Twitter, just like you always call it brag. I will as well. I can't call it X. I'm trying to get there, but follow him at Hal Weatherman NC. Again, at Hal Weatherman NC. Visit his website, HalWeatherman4NC.com. Follow him on Facebook as well. Hashtag him as Handshake Hal. That is like, I'm taking all the credit for that. I love it. Hal, we are so grateful that you take time out of your busy day to come spend time with our listeners, share your vision, share your experience. I do think what you bring to the table as the Republican nominee is you know, really unsurpassed, really the true true commitment. So where are you shaking hands this week before we go?
So I'm not going to lie to you. Well, I'm going down to the coast, and I can't remember where I'm going. I'm looking over Isaac. Am I going to Onslow? I'm going, yeah, Curry Beach.
Excellent.
So I'm going there. But then I'm leaving there, and I'm actually going to Greenville, South Carolina, because my son, who is a runner,
collegiate athlete
has his first cross country meet of the season Friday night. It's a late thing, so I can actually still do my campaigning during the day and get to that Friday night. So I'm really excited about that.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
I mean, love his cross country season.
Yeah, isn't it great? And you know, as a dad and a husband, keeping that commitment and balance is so critically important as you travel the state. I think it's people don't recognize the incredible sacrifice that you make as a candidate, but the sacrifices of your family as well. Any candidate's family really make tremendous sacrifices.
Well, he has a good shot. I'm bragging about my son Hayes. He has a good shot to finish in the top 10. I'm not saying he's going to finish. He has a good shot, which is hard in college. It's really hard. So he's going to go for it. Whether he makes it or not, it's irrelevant to me. I love to watch him perform. But, you know, he told me the other day, I got a good shot at this meet, Dad. I'm going to try to score a top 10 in this, which is good, you know, because it'd be hundreds of people. And I'm like, go for it.
There you go.
Go for it.
There we go. A very gifted cross-country runner.
Oh, yeah.
I love it. Well, Hal Weatherman, again, visit his website, HalWeatherman4NC.com. Follow him on Twitter, at HalWeatherman NC, Republican nominee for lieutenant governor. Don't forget, absentee ballots are going to be hitting mailboxes in 3 days.
I know.
It is the craziest early voting season, craziest political season I think we've ever seen. We are so grateful. Again, thanks for coming in.